Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Deborah Wong. It's Here and Now. At noon today, in cities across Spain, millions of people paused in rainy streets to mourn the dead and wounded from yesterday's train bombing in Madrid. And huge crowds are gathering throughout Spain this evening to condemn the attacks. Nerves are still raw in the Spanish capital. Crowds fled the Atocha railway station in panic after an anonymous caller phoned in a bomb threat. The call turned out to be a hoax. Almost 200 people were killed yesterday. Nearly 1,500 people were wounded. I spoke earlier with Joshua Levitt, correspondent for the Financial Times, who's covering the story, and I asked him how residents of Madrid are coping the day after.
I think one of the important things about terrorism in Spain is that this is a country that is actually quite used to this. Unlike in New York and Washington, where it was the first time there had been such a big attack, Spaniards have been living with ETA, which is this armed separatist group, which is one of the biggest suspects in this case, of the past 30 years.
But they've never seen an attack on such a scale, have they?
Nope, never. I mean, one of the things that happened today was 15 minutes of silence, and there's also going to be a march. There should be millions attending tonight. It's about 7 o'clock our time. I think people are not as much in shock as they were in New York, but certainly very, very concerned. Very concerned, very angry, very much against terrorism.
Now, yesterday the government was pretty quick to blame the Basque separatist group ETA, but now we're hearing that the investigation is also looking at the possibility of Islamic terrorists?
Certainly, certainly. It's interesting in that the sort of the modus operandi of both groups doesn't really fit the case. ETA usually doesn't act like this, and from what they found, Al-Qaeda probably doesn't act like this either. So there's a little bit of both, which makes it very hard to pinpoint. And the evidence that there's been so far has been very slow in coming.
Elections are scheduled to go ahead on Sunday as planned. What kind of impact on the voting do you think this attack is going to have?
That's the big question. I think had it been clear from the beginning on who was the culprit, would have been quite obvious to which party would be benefit from it. The Popular Party, which is a conservative government led by José María Aznar, who's an ally of the U.S., has been very, very hard against ETA. And if it turns out that this was an ETA attack, people would likely to vote for him because he's been very good at he's probably the best that we've had in getting against them. On the other hand, if it turns out that it's Al-Qaeda, or there's even a doubt that it is, or there's even uncertainty that it could be, the Socialist Party, which is in the opposition, certainly could gain. It was Aznar's decision to go into Iraq that probably upset Al-Qaeda, if we're speaking about it in such terms.
And it was a highly unpopular decision when the government did decide to join the United States. So you're seeing that there is a possibility for a backlash against the ruling party?
Certainly, certainly. I think the first thing that will happen is that people will be motivated to vote. One of the reasons why the government did so well in the last elections was that about 2 million voters from the left stayed at home. I think what's going to happen now is there'll be a much higher turnout, probably a record turnout, and a lot of those people that are socialists will have to make a decision. The problem is, if our country is under siege, do you want to have a complete regime change 3 days after? And that's another question. And that's the question people, socialist voters or socialist members, will have to decide on Sunday.
Joshua, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Joshua Levitt is a correspondent for the Financial Times. He joined us from Madrid. In Russia, voters will go to the polls on Sunday to choose their next president, and the winner will be Vladimir Putin. Almost no one doubts the outcome of this, the third presidential election since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Surveys show more than 80% of Russian voters back Mr. Putin. His closest rivals are in the single digits. But some opposition figures are urging Russians to boycott Sunday's vote, and many observers are increasingly concerned over the health of Russia's democracy. Scott Peterson is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, the poll numbers seem to indicate that Putin is a shoo-in. Can you explain why he's so popular?
President Putin has really brought back a sense of direction and vision for many, many Russians. I mean, really a sense of stability that many of them say they crave. So he's brought the kind of things that have, for example, doubled tensions. He has overseen an economy that has improved thanks to higher oil prices. He has brought back what he calls the dictatorship of the law. And that is something that that 80% of Russians, as you say, relish.
So life is better for ordinary Russians. But his critics also argue that he's unfairly used the power of his office and particularly control over the state media in this re-election bid. Is that the case?
That is correct. And in fact, it's kind of been a trade-off in this presidency. Of course, the background of President Putin is as a KGB colonel. And so when he talks about democracy, there are a lot of Democrats who are in Russia who feel that he really isn't very serious about it. What a lot of critics see is they see that during his tenure, he has taken strong steps to control the media. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why the only message that has gotten out across the broadest area of Russia has been the message that's gone out through the television.
Now, the opposition says that this control of the state media is just one indication that Putin is trying to bring about another authoritarian state in Russia. Is that a widely held view?
It's not the kind of thing that most Russians fear in the way that many people in the West do. For them, a more authoritarian state simply means a stronger state. It means that someone is sober and capable at the, you know, who's at the tiller. If that means that a few civil liberties are taken away, well, so be it.
Now, under election rules, if fewer than 50% of the electorate turns out to vote, the election is considered null and void. Could that happen?
It could happen, and it is one of the biggest fears of the Kremlin. My sense is that the president, while he has wanted to portray a level playing field, if you will, in terms of the campaign, some of his operatives have gone far, far too far on the other side, which has been to really make the very small, no-hope opposition candidates look bad to the point where several of them have dropped out. And really, I think from President Putin's point of view, if those candidates were to drop out, then it really would make this election a complete farce because he would practically be the only candidate left on the ballot. One of the surprising things that most opponents of Vladimir Putin put forward is they wonder why the Kremlin has felt the need to continue with the kind of pressure against the opposition that they have done, considering that Putin has such high approval ratings. And many of them feel that the fact that the Kremlin has been seen to continue to exert this kind of pressure really does undermine to a degree the legitimacy of this vote.
Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is the Christian Science Monitor correspondent in Moscow. And this note, thousands of supporters of South Korean President Noh Moo-hyun are crowded outside the country's National Assembly following the president's impeachment today. Lawmakers voted to strip Noh of his constitutional powers after 3 days of raucous debate that featured one Noh supporter setting himself on fire and another protester trying to drive his car up the parliament steps. Critics say that Noh has mismanaged the economy and his administration has also been embroiled in several corruption scandals. The U.S. Senate has confirmed a new head for the Medicare program. Mark McClellan, the president's choice for the job, is currently in charge of the Food and Drug Administration. But McClellan's 2 a.m. confirmation came only after he was grilled by senators on the Commerce Committee over his opposition to the importation of low-cost drugs from Canada. At the same hearing, an influential Republican senator, Trent Lott of Mississippi, announced that he would reverse his own opposition to cross-border pharmacies. Kate Schuler is the health policy reporter with the Congressional Quarterly. And Kate, why were senators giving Mark McClellan such a hard time?
Well, Mark McClellan, as head of FDA, has been very strident in his opposition to the practice of reimporting drugs from Canada and other countries. And senators on the Commerce Committee, particularly John McCain, were very upset about his stance on this. So they really gave him a hard time asking him why the FDA could not guarantee the safety of imported drugs. We do it for food, was their argument. And McClellan kept repeating that the safety issue was their main concern.
The senators were also angry that Dr. McClellan had not testified on this issue before.
Right. Senators McCain and Senator Dorgan from the Commerce Committee had asked Dr. McClellan to appear before them several times to talk about drug importation, and McClellan had never come before them. And this caused the senators, Senator Dorgan put a hold on his nomination in the Senate that would have prevented him from getting confirmed until he came to speak before them. And so that really put pressure on McClellan to finally come and talk to them. And so when he did, the senators were really upset and angry, and they questioned him repeatedly about why he had refused to testify and emphasized the importance that he would have to do this when he becomes head of Medicare and Medicaid in his new position.
But did you detect any kind of shift in his position in his defense of the ban on imported drugs?
The past week or two, it has seemed to be a bit of a softening in that he has expressed, he said, an absolute willingness to work with Congress on a bill that would give FDA the resources. His chief concern was that if they allowed reimportation, the FDA would just be overrun. There's no way that they could do it all with the resources that they have right now. And so he was saying to Congress, if you give us the resources, if you give us the direction, we'll work with you.
So a little bit of softening there.
Yes.
Now, we also heard yesterday that Senator Trent Lott, the Mississippi senator and former Republican leader, announced that he has changed his mind on the importation of low-cost prescription drugs, and he, in fact, now supports the idea.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, that was quite a surprise in the hearing yesterday. He introduced his switch by saying that he could not explain to his mother any longer why she should pay twice or two-thirds more than what is paid in Canada and Mexico. So he brought his mother into it, saying, there's just no way I can tell her anymore that this is defensible. So he said that he's switching his position. He says next time there's a vote on reimportation, he'll be voting to support it. And I think this is an indication of how the winds are shifting on this. There's been a lot of publicity about the Medicare prescription drug bill that Republicans had really hoped would solve a lot of these problems. But that's not really the way things have been going. Seniors don't understand the bill. Democrats are really using that to their advantage and saying it doesn't help them very much. So the pressure is really building up there, and Lott and I believe a lot of other senators are really rethinking this.
So how does this change the political calculus in Congress? There are several proposals now before the members that would allow prescription drugs in from Canada. Do any of them have a better prospect of succeeding now?
Well, the House passed a bill last year that is sort of languishing in the Senate right now that would allow importation from 24 countries. But the more likely scenario is Senator Grassley now, who is head of the Finance Committee, is working on a bill with Senator Kennedy that would give the FDA resources. That's the key here, that it would give the FDA resources and direction in how to go about this. Senator Kennedy is another one who has changed his stance on this in the past few months, and now he is working with Senator Grassley on a bill. And I do think that we will see something. I don't think that these senators are willing to let it drop now.
Kate, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Kate Schuler is the health policy reporter with the Congressional Quarterly. And just ahead, they don't want to talk about it, but George W. Bush and John Kerry have something in common: membership in a super secret society at Yale University. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Wong. It's Here and Now. 8 months before the election, the task for President Bush and his presumptive challenger, Senator John Kerry, is to highlight their differences for the voters. Though they don't want to talk about it, the two men also share a bond: membership in an exclusive organization, the secret society known as Skull and Bones at Yale University, the alma mater of both men. It's made up of select Yale seniors who meet covertly, and they enjoy a powerful and connected alumni network. Alexandra Robbins has researched Skull and Bones and written a book, Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power. And she joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
First of all, could you describe Skull and Bones? What is it? Is it a social club, a fraternity, a cult?
None of the above. Skull and Bones is basically America's most powerful and infamous secret society. And it's so intensely secret that many Americans don't know it exists or aren't willing to believe it. Based at Yale, where it's headquartered in a building called the Tomb, Skull and Bones has included among its members presidents, Supreme Court chief justices, CIA officials, cabinet members, congressmen, and senators, including, of course, John Kerry, which will make the presidential election of 2004 the first Bonesman versus Bonesman ballot. The reason that's so staggering is because Skull and Bones is not a large club. There are maybe 800 living members at any one time.
Now, of course, the whole idea behind secret societies is that its members are not supposed to talk about it, but you did manage to shed some light on this group, starting with how new members are chosen or tapped. Can you describe that?
Yeah, basically between January and April of their senior year at Yale, the 15 current Yale students who are members of Skull and Bones spend their meeting time sifting through the entire junior class at Yale to find the people who they believe will reflect the most honor and success back onto the society. They're really only looking for people who will achieve prestigious positions later in life, or as in the case of George W. Bush, who are legacies.
And these are movers and shakers on campus? I mean, is this a sort of meritocracy or kind of an old boys network?
A little of both. It's starting to change over to meritocracy, but historically it's really been an old boys network, and it's still run that way.
So going back to the story, these people are chosen, and then what happens?
In April, the new 15 members of Skull and Bones are initiated in a series of rituals that are somewhat bizarre and somewhat sophomoric. It sort of resembles something from a Harry Potter novel. They scatter for summer break, and then when they come back for their senior year at Yale, they spend every Thursday and Sunday night, about 6 or 7 hours a night, meeting in the tomb. And people have wondered what goes on beyond those walls. Some of the stuff is really pretty strange.
It's a windowless building.
Yes.
And it has some very interesting decor, as you describe.
Oh, sure. There are dozens of skeletons and skulls gripping the walls. There's art celebrating death. There's war memorabilia, and there are several allegedly stolen items that members of Skull and Bones were supposedly encouraged to take as gifts to the society's goddess.
And is there a reason for this obsession with death?
Well, I was told that there is an unspoken pressure within Skull and Bones to succeed. So supposedly the death motif is supposed to remind you that life is short and you don't have long to succeed.
So tell us about some of these rather unusual rituals that go on within the walls of the tomb.
Well, one of the most interesting is the sexual history. Each member of the society gets an entire evening devoted to him or her, and they're standing up in front of the other 14 seniors. They're supposed to recount their entire sexual history, presumably from the first self-gratifying experience on through present day.
Okay. Now, Bush and Kerry were a couple of years apart, but there's a lot of speculation about whether the two had any dealings with each other through Skull and Bones. Did you manage to shed any light on that?
It's certainly possible that that happened after they both graduated, but I don't see how they would have run into each other in Skull and Bones while Bush was a member, because when he was tapped, Kerry had already graduated and probably gone on to Vietnam. Afterwards, I'd be surprised if they didn't run into each other at some point, because the alumni, or they're called patriarchs in Skull and Bones, are encouraged to come back to the tomb and participate in alumni functions as often as possible.
When President Bush was asked about his Skull and Bones membership, he said, "It's so secret I can't talk about it." Now, how did you find people who would talk to you for your book?
I was a member of a different secret society at Yale called Scroll and Key. I told this to the members of Skull and Bones with whom I spoke. They automatically assumed that Scroll and Key was the same thing as Skull and Bones and that I would be on their side. Actually, Scroll and Key is nothing like Skull and Bones. Skull and Bones' only agenda is to get members into positions of power and then to have those members hire other Bonesmen. But another reason, I think, is because a lot of the Bonesmen are sort of tired of the secrecy, tired of the mysterious code of silence, and they're tired of some of the more malicious members who take the club so seriously.
The society also seems to be somewhat hidebound. They didn't induct women until the 1990s, is that correct?
Yeah, in 1991, the Bones seniors in the society, the students, intended to tap women. The alumni heard about the plan, changed the locks of the tomb, and threatened to shut down the society for a year rather than let women in. The seniors threatened a lawsuit. Bones held a vote that narrowly endorsed admitting women. But the day before initiation, a group of Bonesmen led by William F. Buckley obtained a court order blocking initiation, claiming that admitting women would lead to, and I'm quoting here, date rape in the medium-term future. Again, a fight back and forth. Eventually, there was a second vote. Women were allowed in. Kerry has disclosed that he voted in to allow women in. The Bushes have never disclosed which way they voted.
Uh-huh. Now, even though you are a member of a secret society, you take exception to the fact that the president and possibly the future president are members of a secret organization. Why?
I don't think that the elected officials who represent our country, especially the president, should be allowed to have an allegiance to any secret group. And I think they're showing that allegiance by refusing to talk about their secret society. Secrecy pretty much overshadows democracy. And I really don't think it's a coincidence that the most secretive government in America since at least the Nixon era, probably before, is run by a member of the country's most infamous secret society.
Alexandra, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Alexandra Robbins is author of Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, The Ivy League, and The Hidden Paths of Power. She's also author of a new book, Pledged, The Secret Life of Sororities.
Do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, 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 closer.
And there's more ahead, here and now.
Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to
I'm Deborah Wong. Bill and Robin are off today. It's Here and Now. The race for the presidency is heating up fast. Last night, the Bush campaign released a new series of campaign ads attacking John Kerry's record. Here's an excerpt.
A president sets his agenda for America in the first 100 days. John Kerry's plan? To pay for new government spending, raise taxes by at least $900 billion.
Now, these are the first negative ads from the Bush campaign directly. And today, John Kerry will release a response ad of his own. It's still being finalized, but campaign officials tell us it's titled Misleading and asks the question, doesn't America deserve more from its president than misleading negative ads? Well, for more, we turn to Dorothy Rabinowitz, columnist and editorial board member at The Wall Street Journal. Hello, Dorothy.
Hello.
And Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Deborah.
Well, does it seem to both of you, maybe starting with you, Bill, that this campaign is getting nasty very early on?
Way too early. We here in Maine, we've been identified as one of the 17 so-called battleground states with our paltry 4 electoral votes. And I got to tell you, we're, on the one hand, I guess a little humbled by this, but at the same time, the people I'm talking to are kind of horrified at the prospect of watching this stuff, not for the typical 2 or 3 months after Labor Day, but for the whole summer and spring.
Dorothy, is it likely to get worse?
Oh, it's likely to get worse, but I can't help thinking that the word misleading is really one of those political wimp words, considering misleading. This is, I mean, consider what John Kerry said. These guys are liars and thieves. Whatever he said, off the record, of course.
Right.
But it may as well be a national political ad, given the coverage. It's in the air, so I really don't see why we can't have the ads doing that. And I find this, I have to say, a lot better than the bizarre attack on Bush for using the images of the downed World Trade Center in his ads, and that fairly loathsome discussion generated by the 9/11 family core of political activists.
You know, we want to get to that later, but let's go back to these ads and the remark that you mentioned. This was, of course, the remark that Kerry made this week, supposedly off mic. He calling his opponents the most crooked, lying group I've ever seen. Now, Dorothy, are you saying that you want to see that kind of language in the ads?
No. I'm saying that compared to that, words, you know, about Bush, like misleading and misleading ads, this is nothing. I think that ads should represent the rancor that is truly in the air. So let us have at it.
My only criticism of the remarks that were caught on the mic is that he wasn't more specific.
Yeah. Yes.
I guess he didn't have time. But I think that people who are considering that an accident, I have my doubts. I mean, John Kerry's been around for a long time. He knows when he's wired and when he's not. In fact, if you look at the tape, he was in the process of, it appeared to be, disentangling himself from the various mics and things. So, you know, he knew he was in range. And I think I would tend to agree with Dorothy in as much as I don't think that was accidental, and I think it was intended as part of the opening round.
So, Bill, you really want to see more of that kind of talk, but what about for the voters at large? Are these remarks going to hurt him, you think, in the eyes of voters?
I think people have a saturation point on this stuff, and it's going to be interesting to see when it's reached. It's very early, and it's very bitter. This reminds me, a couple of weeks ago, the Red Sox and the Yankees had their first spring training game, and players on both sides were amazed at the turnout and at the passion of the fans. And the reason, of course, is that none of these fans have forgotten what happened in October. Well, similarly, I think the same thing is happening between the Democrats and the Republicans right now. 2000 remains very fresh in many people's memories, and I think that goes a long way toward explaining why things are kicking off and why things are so hot so early right now.
Well, let's talk specifically about these Bush ads. They call Kerry wrong on taxes, wrong on defense. A couple of things from the ads. He wants to weaken the Patriot Act used to arrest terrorists and protect America. And he accuses Kerry of delaying defending America until the United Nations approve. What do you think? Do you think these are fair?
Well, anything's fair, you know, once you resort to this kind of communication. And, I mean, there are, both sides are going to say things that the other side is reflexively going to counter as either untrue or taken out of context or whatever. I mean, that's the name of the game. I think the risk that Bush runs more than Kerry right now is that he's the president. And I think that it's a lot easier for him to defend his 9/11 ads as here's George Bush in his defining moment being presidential than for him to be taking off the gloves before Easter. And what Bush is doing is getting down and dirty, perhaps a little too soon.
Getting down, maybe, but I don't think there's anything dirty about those two charges because there is that truth that Kerry, you know, has done nothing but assault the Patriot Act, and he certainly wanted to go to the UN. But I think you have the larger point is I think there's something to that. I think he may be taking some wrong advice about when to go and flailing into this, and also he's haunted by the ghost of his father. And it's wrong to be driven by the past in that degree. His father didn't do anything, take off any gloves, and he paid for it with a loss.
Now, Dorothy, you had mentioned the September 11 imagery in Bush's earlier ads. The Bush campaign acknowledges that it's made a conscious decision to make September 11th a guiding theme in this re-election bid, and whether or not that is a good strategy.
Well, I certainly think it's the best strategy.
Well, it's the only strategy.
Well, yes,
right,
I agree. Yes, it's the best strategy.
I mean, whatever happened to the shot on the aircraft carrier? That was supposed to be the defining moment of this re-election campaign. That's why they shot it. And that's gathering dust somewhere because things militarily haven't gone quite as they anticipated at the time they shot that footage. But, you know, I mean, so as a result, they had to go back to 9/11.
Well, you know, why don't we just think about what is the true, genuine moral impact of these things? Does Bush deserve to have these images and to be a part of his campaign? And I think that's what one ought to address. I think the answer is profoundly yes. He was the man. He was there. And I cannot see, you know, the use of it or lack of use of it is relevant. I think they're going with their proper instincts. No one thought about George Bush as a serious, significant president as much as when they saw him that day.
You know, Deborah, there's a variable here, too, that plays into it being so early, and that is a lot can happen between now and November. We just had the attacks in Spain, and now there's talk that they're 90% ready for another major attack on the United States. It's a very unstable world right now, and I think all of us would be naive if we were to sit here right now and assume that there's not going to be at least one, maybe more major events between now and November that are beyond everyone's control.
Well, let's hope not.
Mm. Yeah.
Bill Nemitz is a columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Bill, thank you.
My pleasure, Deb.
And Dorothy Rabinowitz is a columnist and an editorial board member at the Wall Street Journal. Dorothy, thanks.
Thanks very much.
And still to come, actor Johnny Depp is back on the big screen in the suspense thriller Secret Window. You're listening to Here and Now. The discovery of mad cow disease in the U.S. prompted many consumer advocates to call for more widespread testing of cattle. Currently, the USDA tests only about 40,000 cows a year. But what happens if a farmer wants to test his own cattle for bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, and even use his own money for the testing? The answer is he simply can't. That's what David Luker discovered. He's the owner of Missouri Valley Natural Beef, and he joins me on the line from his farm in Chemung, Missouri. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Well, you have a small business, about 160 head of cattle. And can you explain why you want your cattle tested for mad cow? Are you worried about their health?
I'm not worried about their health, but we serve a customer base that has made the request that they would feel more comfortable with our beef supply that we present if we were able to screen our cattle at time of slaughter for BSE.
So you went to the USDA, which is the only agency that tests for mad cow, and they run one testing facility in Iowa. And what did they tell you when you asked them?
Well, they tried to discourage me from doing it. And when I told them that if they wouldn't do it or couldn't do it, if they could send me to another pathology lab where we could have the screening done. And that's when they told me there's nobody else in the United States that can do it or will do it. And if they find anyone else trying to do it, that the whoever does it runs the risk of being prosecuted.
What was your reaction to that?
I was shocked. USDA is a valuable resource to the farming industry. And to have a resource that I depend on to help me produce wholesome products that my customers want, to give me that type of response was just shocking.
Now, the USDA has a monopoly on testing because they say they're worried that consumers might become confused if there's all sorts of people out there testing, if every producer is making a claim that can't really be substantiated. Now, do you buy that reasoning?
We have a very educated consumer base in this country, and people want whatever diagnostic testing that can be done on the food that they eat. And if there needs to be a disclaimer put on that this is not an absolute test, customers will buy that. Consumers will accept that. And I don't see what the big deal is.
Have you lost any customers because you haven't been able to go back and tell them that you have tested your beef?
Yeah, we've actually had a couple of people that were wanting to be customers that have actually stopped eating beef because we've been unsuccessful in getting the screening work done.
Well, it's interesting because a recent poll found that a majority of American farmers actually oppose mandatory testing, I suppose, because they say the beef supply is safe. So aren't you going against the kind of the grain within your own industry?
Oh, I guess one could look at it like that. The way I look at it is you can always tell who the pioneers are because they're the people with the arrows sticking in them. I think this is more of a pioneering venture to help improve the confidence of the consumer with our beef supply.
Now, the USDA has announced plans to test more cows in the future. Is there any way that you can get on some list so that the USDA can come to you and test first?
With the number of beef being processed in this country, I believe that if you have beef that wants to be tested, you should have access to that testing. And if everyone doesn't want to do it, that's okay with me. But if my customers want to do it and have it done, I would like to have access to the service.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Luker owns Missouri Valley Natural Beef in Chemung, Missouri. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Deborah Wong. It's Here and Now. In the new suspense thriller Secret Window, Johnny Depp stars as Mort Rainey, a writer whose life has gone downhill. He has writer's block, his soon-to-be ex-wife is with another man, and if that weren't bad enough, a stranger shows up at the door of his isolated cottage with a claim that can strike fear into the heart of any author.
You stole my story.
I don't believe I know you.
I know that. That doesn't matter. I know you, Mr. Rainey. That's what matters. You stole my story.
You're mistaken. I don't read my newspaper.
You read this one already. You stole it.
I can assure you that
I know you can. I know that. I don't want to be assured.
If you want to talk to someone about some grievance you feel you may have, you can call my literary agent.
This is between you and me.
I don't like
Johnny Depp and John Turturro playing the persistent John Shooter. Secret Window opens nationwide today. And joining us with her review is Here and Now film critic Renee Graham. Welcome, Renee.
Hi, Deborah.
So tell us more about this mysterious stranger.
Mysterious stranger, John Shooter. John Shooter is just a hick straight out of Central Casting.
Sounds like it.
You know, he's got the big black hat. He's got this huge drawl. And he arrives on Johnny Depp's doorstep one day claiming that Johnny Depp stole one of his short stories. And from that moment, we're off. Shooter wants satisfaction. He doesn't seem to want any sort of financial compensation, but he wants satisfaction. And one of the things he keeps telling Depp's character is, I want you to go back to my original ending. You changed the ending. Go back to my original conclusion because it was perfect.
And Johnny Depp has no idea what he's talking about?
He doesn't have any idea what he's talking about, but there, throughout the movie, there's this idea that's constantly brought up that at some other point in his career, Johnny Depp had plagiarized someone else's story and had to settle out of court. So that sort of lets it be known that there's a possibility that he did steal this guy's story.
Okay. Now, Secret Window really is a vehicle for Johnny Depp, and we loved him in Pirates of the Caribbean, and he was nominated for an Oscar for that role. What about his work here?
It's completely and utterly a vehicle for Johnny Depp. Beyond Johnny Depp, the film is really pretty slight and somewhat predictable, but the entire film hinges on Johnny Depp's performance. And for the most part, he's playing what's essentially his public persona as this chain-smoking, Jack Daniels-drinking bohemian with a penchant for unkempt hair, beauty-deflecting horn-rimmed glasses, and ratty sweaters. And, you know, it's hard for me to believe that he didn't ad-lib a great deal in this film because there are just these little interesting asides. He has a, you know, a line about Tammy Wynette's song, D-I-V-O-R-C-E. He has an offhand remark about the Talking Heads song, Once in a Lifetime. He quotes some of the lyrics. And perhaps most obscure at all, he does a Jose Feliciano imitation of Jose Feliciano singing the theme from Chico and the Man. And so I just don't think those are things that are written in the script. They seem more like Johnny Depp. And it's somewhat reminiscent of the performance he gave in Once Upon a Time in Mexico last year, which was sort of, you know, peppered with these pop culture references.
And some of the other performances in the film, how about John Turturro?
John Turturro basically has to be vengeful and menacing, and it's a little over the top, but that's fine for the character. There's also Charles S. Dutton, who plays a private detective that Johnny Depp hires to find out more about this guy, John Shooter.
Okay, I got it. Don't worry. Once I find out where the shooter's staying, I'll stop in for a little freak-me-out chat. Use the word we a lot. We know what you're doing. We wanted to stop. We're watching you.
Yeah.
Trust me, he'll hit the road so hard, it'll hit back.
And there's also a smaller role by played by Timothy Hutton. He plays the boyfriend of Depp's soon-to-be ex-wife, played by Maria Bello.
Look, Mort, a lot of what's going on right now is my fault. Most of it, in fact. What do you want? I want you out of our life. Gotta sign your papers, Mort.
That's Timothy Hutton's character trying to encourage Johnny Depp to sign the final divorce papers.
Good performances from them?
You know, Timothy Hutton's performance is a little sad. It doesn't have a lot to do. It's not a huge role, and he's fine for what it is, but anyone could have played it. And you watch it and you go, wow, this guy had an Oscar. This guy once had a fairly promising career, and now he's gotten a role that, you know, any TV actor could have played.
So you really need to go to see this film for Johnny Depp.
This is a movie for Johnny Depp completists, for the people who went to see The Astronaut's Wife and Blow and The Ninth Gate. You know, he's not as enjoyably over the top as he was in Pirates of the Caribbean, and this isn't as fully realized a character as he played in What's Eating Gilbert Grape. It's fine. It's not his finest performance, but, you know, if you love Johnny Depp, you'll probably like the movie.
Now, if you love Stephen King, this is based on a Stephen King short story. The question is, Is it scary? Is this a compelling Stephen King story?
You know, I didn't find it particularly scary, and this is fairly well-traveled King territory. You know, isolated writers battling demons, real or imagined. We've seen this in Misery. We've seen this in The Shining. So it's a pretty familiar premise for Stephen King.
This film is rated PG-13. It's not a film for kids?
I would say no. There are scenes of violence, and it can be a little intense for kids, definitely.
How about for the rest of us? I mean, I get to see a movie once every 3 months. Is this the movie that I should go see?
You know, if you like movies with references to Tammy Wynette and Jose Feliciano, you'll have a great time. You know, again, Johnny Depp has been better. There are better films from Johnny Depp you can rent. But, you know, it's fine for what it is. If you're not looking for something too taxing and you like watching Johnny Depp for 90 minutes, then this will be a great film for you.
Renee, thanks very much.
Thanks, Deborah.
Here and Now film critic Renee Graham. We've been reviewing Secret Window, which opens nationwide today. And as to films that could open in the future, Bill Delaney has more.
Mel Gibson's epic The Passion of the Christ is going into its third weekend, with the box office take already over $200 million, which inspired Ty Burr, movie critic of the Boston Globe, to some thinking. Since blockbusters often inspire copycats, what other religious movies could be following in The Passion's wake? Ty Burr joins us in the studio. Welcome, Ty.
Thanks.
Ty, you decided to make your own studio pitches. Give me an example with religiously themed studio
pitches. Religiously themed, because, you know, Hollywood does love a successful idea and will take it to the bank over and over again until there's no more money to be gotten out of it.
That's right.
So, you know, this was a piece I just sort of had to write. I wasn't even assigned. I just wrote it, gave it to the editor, and you want to run it? So, you know, this is brainstorming. This is studio brainstorming. I thought, you know, first one, Buddha, The Revenge of Siddhartha. And the concept here would be that the Bodhisattva, Vin Diesel, played by Vin Diesel, comes back from the Bo Tree looking to even the score against the five companions who dissed him for seeking the middle way. And if you hold on long enough through the movie, you get to the big showdown with Mara, the Lord of Misfortune, which is done with, like, high-grade CGI, the best CGI you've ever seen.
It sounds very promising indeed.
Yeah, I think it could work. Yeah. Keanu Reeves has already played Little Buddha. You know, why not Vin Diesel?
This would be a big Buddha movie.
Exactly. You got it.
And, you know, but you go well beyond Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Judaism,
yes. Holy Moses. The concept here is that Moses leads his people out of enslavement, and this time they're singing and dancing. And, you know, the nice thing about, you know, religious movies in the post-Passion of the Christ era is that we can finally get all the gore, you know, and all the gusto that, you know, these religious epics really deserve. So, you know, that we got the 10 plagues here. You got the boils, the frogs, the death of the firstborn. Finally, we can see them as they were meant to be seen.
The Bible as it was meant to
exactly.
be seen on the big screen.
And for this, I'm seeing
no holds barred.
J-Lo as Zipporah. And Owen Wilson as the golden calf.
These are not only pitches, you're also including casting
concepts.
Oh,
yeah. Well, you got to bring, you know, the stars have to be attached.
And now sticking with the great monotheistic religions, you also Islam.
That's a little tricky because Islam, you know, you can't show Muhammad. In fact, there was a movie made back in the 70s in which he was not shown. And he's the star of the movie and you don't see him. So I couldn't come up with a casting idea. Nevertheless, you know, you set it during the Hajira to Medina. You cast Lainey Kazan as his wife. And you know, you make it a situation comedy. She wants to settle down at every oasis. His followers keep borrowing the Koran and forgetting to return it because, as you know, there's only one at that point. And, you know, it's a situation comedy. It doesn't work on the big screen. You can take it to TV.
And moving Ty into even more mystical realms, you're even addressing the 6th century B.C. Chinese sage Lao Tzu.
Well, I was actually intrigued by the fact that Confucius and Lao Tzu did, in fact, meet. Historically, they met in the 6th century B.C., and that Confucius is rumored to have said, birds fly, fish swim, animals run, and, you know, I have met the dragon and it is Lao Tzu. I see a buddy comedy going on here. You know, you got Jet Li, Chow Yun-Fat. They contemplate, they kick some butt. You know, it works out.
Are you worried at all? And did you get any criticism after you published your piece with these pitches in it?
You know, I was expecting something. I was expecting some angry letters. I got nothing.
Movie critic Ty Burr of the Boston Globe with some pitches he hopes will be his way to paying off the mortgage here.
Yeah, and you know, if any of these show up on the screen, I'm expecting a cut.
Movie critic Ty Burr of the Boston Globe, thanks.
Sure, my pleasure. Bodhisattva, which take me by the hand.
Bodhisattva, which take me by the hand. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Wong. Bill and Robin will be back on Monday. In the meantime, get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. I'm gonna sell my house in town. Bodhisattva, I'm gonna sell my house in town. And I'll be there, shining down the
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.